The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What is the Book of Rachels?
Well, in Shaking Out the Dead, the Book of Rachels, it's a part of a family tradition where it's a book that's passed down through the generations to the daughter who is named Rachel, and it gives them a sense of the history of that family name. It also marks that person as special in some way, especially if they're siblings in the family. And I think within the book, its importance in part is that even getting that designation as special can be a trap, as can any label or any designation.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the west side of the United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Kate Holava, author of a novel titled Shaking Out the Dead. You explore the idea of love from many angles, because as in life, love is complicated in this novel. Tatum's friend Paris wants to be more than her friend, although he's determined not to want. And it's a determination we find out about in the first paragraph of the book, which I'd like you to read.
Sure. Paris was a Montanan without a myth. He didn't ride horses, hunt, fish, or ski. He had never worn a cowboy hat or squinted across the range. Paris was blue-collar bred, and his body was strong, built not by gyms and barbells, but by physical work and carless, pedestrian life. Behind his eyes there were no big skies, just a duty-bound psyche. His destiny, his purpose, he thought, was to notice the pretty and the bad, the ugly and the good, see it and let it be. He decided long ago he would not want. He would lighten the burden of the world, be one less pair of sticky hands.
That's a great paragraph.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about wanting for a minute. Paris really likes routine. That, I think, helps him feel safe and secure. And about the idea of wanting more, at one point in the book, he thinks spring, summer, fall, winter, over and over, the planet never wearies of it, never wants more. And yet he wants his relationship with Tatum to be different. How does he deal with that wanting and wanting not to want?
And that's certainly Paris's conflict. He also wants to not want to pressure Tatum in any way, too, because he does love her. He wouldn't want to expect anything from her that wasn't hers to give freely. So desire certainly is complicated for Paris. And it's, I think, definitely a theme in the whole book, too, how to manage desire. He wants to accept things. You know, he wants to be happy with the world as it is. Therefore, his feelings for Tatum aren't just about that relationship. They actually are upsetting and undermine his entire approach to life.
Geneva is a really intriguing character. She's always trying to figure things out, especially her marriage. And she wants to give events and people meaning beyond the obvious, which is probably a good thing since she's an advice columnist. Describe what's going on with her.
I really enjoy the character Geneva. I really enjoyed writing her. And it was interesting for me because I was working on this novel for at least a year before the character Geneva appeared. And for quite some time, I was worried that I was being sidetracked by a character that really wasn't part of this story, which clearly turned out not to be the case. But when it comes to approaching love, like we mentioned, it's an important part of this book. I think that Geneva's definitely the example of the kind of person who's trying to, in some ways, think her way into love. Like, she sees love as something she committed to do. And so she's going to use her mind to try to make that so. You know, her husband has Alzheimer's in the book. So she even struggles with, what does it mean to love this person I'm with now versus experiencing love as a memory? How does she bring love into the present? But I think that the tricky thing is it's all in her mind. And really, we can't talk ourselves into love. We're using the wrong mechanism.
She's always thinking about her actions in relationship to how someone has responded to her. And I think in the case of her husband, he must love me because he did this or said that.
I thought this was actually sort of an interesting thing about the character Geneva, in that she believes that her husband loved her because he said he did, and she trusted him, which is different than the experience of being loved. So she's trusting him as opposed to trusting her own experience.
You used her relationship with music to show how her relationship with Ralph didn't quite connect.
Yes. You know, I had her tell her story of when she got, I would say, turned on to music, listening to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was a pretty breakthrough album in its time, and how it catapulted her just into the world of music and looking for music and learning about music, the music of the times, and how her husband, Ralph, I liked this part too, how she knew that she, when he came home and she had been listening to this new album all day, and when she asked him to listen, he said, pretty weird. And she thought they'd get divorced for sure, because she felt that something huge and giant had just changed in her life. And it had. And he didn't see it. And he didn't feel it as well. And she talks later about how in the car, he still always chose the music, even though now it was part of her life that she was deeply immersed into. And when he chose music, she also knew that he thought it, that he was choosing something they enjoyed, because she saw it as elevator music, his taste. But she wouldn't want to tell him that she didn't enjoy it, because she knew he got pleasure out of believing they both enjoyed it. And as her idea about how to love appropriately would not be to take away his pleasure in believing that.
There's a lot to think about in this book. In one scene, Geneva's in a coffee shop working on her column, and she writes, quote, two kinds of people believe everything happens for a reason. One kind believes that the reasons reveal themselves in the future. The other kind believes that the reasons lie in the past. What is she getting at there?
Well, I think what she's getting at, and I think what I'm getting at too, is that and perhaps all of us understand in our world of relationships and friends, there's people who, you know, they do. They say everything happens for a reason. And so everything that's happening now is somehow going to be explained in the future, you know, by the way events unfold. However, there's other people, too, who that's a little bit of a sort of a cosmic talk kind of approach to things, and believe in much more of a cause and effect, that it's the past that led us to where we are now. And that's one line in the book, but it's also another theme that runs through the book a little bit. Paris actually thinks about it a lot, too, is cause and effect, and looking for cause and effect. And is there any point to looking for cause and effect?
Well, since you mentioned Paris, I'd like you to read a passage in which he and Tatum are in a park.
The sun bided its time beneath the horizon. Paris had left a spotless kitchen and a balanced drawer for Jerry, the old Vietnam vet who worked the morning shift. Paris passed through the streets on his way to the duplex in the light of lampposts standing proud as trees. Quiet doorways blended with windows and walls in the shadows. Fire escapes crept down brick veneers into benign and potholed alleys. Paris thought about a canvas, a 12x14, he had in his closet. The artist's task, he knew, was not to reduce the world to two dimensions, but to find the proper detail, the curved spoonful of chowder, the fragile turn of a wrist, the fractal that told the larger story and contained the rest of the dimensions. Paris had been saving the canvas, waiting for the perfect idea. His excuse was that canvases were expensive, not to be wasted. The canvas had been in his closet for a year. He reached the library and cut through the park behind it. He passed the concrete water fountain that jutted up from the ground like a squat sentry at the playground's edge. The swing set and slide stood sleepy as trees, caught in the half-dreams of hibernation. He wondered if Tatum, like himself, was unable to cross the park without remembering. It was in this park that Paris had kissed her, that they had kissed. He stepped past the flat metal merry-go-round with its silver bars and chronic tilt. The kiss happened the night they had gone to see a local theater group's production of Picasso et de Lapin à Gilles, a fictional encounter between a young Einstein and young Picasso. The play had launched for Paris a mild obsession with drawing Einstein. Einstein as a janitor, Einstein shooting craps, Einstein selling snow cones. It was a summer night, the middle of July, and Paris and Tatum were walking home after the play, cutting through the park as the day's heat dissipated in the thin mountain air. Tatum's throat rose from the scoop of a black tank top. A small cloth purse, just big enough for folded money, hung from one shoulder across to the opposite hip. Above them, the sky doled out stars. She looked straight ahead as she told Paris that Einstein tried to save the universe from his own equations. When he calculated the destiny of the world as ending in fire or ice, he did more math, she said, grasped for an equation that would say it wasn't so. Did he find one, Paris asked, stopping at the swing set, partitioned off from the lawn on an island of wood chips? Tatum pursed her lips and shook her head no. Then we're doomed? She nodded soberly. Then she reached out and fingered a chain link that led down to a leather strap seat. She eyed the swing up and down, considering taking it for a spin. Paris watched her ringless hand, a hand older than her face. When their eyes met, she smiled, as though at an inside joke that had passed between them. Paris felt the kiss, pressing at the seams of the moment, a gift apart from them, bigger than they, but theirs to deliver into the world. Paris reached to the side of her face. He leaned in, and their lips touched for only a second, but it was a second that included a Mississippi. When they pulled gently apart, Tatum dropped her head, staring down at the seat of the swing. Paris could look only at her, his heart banging in his chest, the word yes understood by him for the first time. Yes, not as an answer, but as a fact. Yes, it surrounded them, suffused them. But he could already see Tatum backing away from it, pretending it was make-believe, a game the wise don't play. But she had it inside out, he was certain. When she spoke, it was with caution, each word selected carefully. Paris, she said, we're friends. You like me as a friend. That's why you kissed me. But if we were to keep on kissing tonight and then tomorrow, it would become different. I'd be your girlfriend. All the reasons you wanted to kiss me would go away. People want different things from friends than from girlfriends. A small pendant earring caught a ray of park light and sparkled. Her eyes were green as a forest. I know, she went on, sounding more nervous, that you're thinking we could be more than friends, but for me there is no such thing. There is no more than. This is as good as I get. As your girlfriend, I would seem like less, not more. I like that you like me. I don't want to disappoint you. Love doesn't cure us of who we are. Paris trusted her, so how could he call her wrong? Her truth swam past him as he stood there in his own. His truth was different from the one she had spoken. His truth was yes. But his mind couldn't shuffle the feeling into anything solid or articulate. He only knew the summer cool air and the intimate space of the swing. He followed the kiss and not her words, not his own thoughts. His lips and skin had not served as a barrier. The kiss was sinking into his waters, floating heavily down into the quietest and darkest place, lodging itself in his sands. Tatum turned away, looking toward the dark lawn and the distant sidewalk. She opened her mouth, about to say more, but was interrupted. A sudden loud ticking surrounded them, the sprinkler system kicking in. They didn't run. Arcs of spray shot up from the grass surrounding them, spigots jerking in circles and whipping sheets of water across the clean-cut lawn. Paris and Tatum ducked but were safe, out of reach on the wood chips. Tatum stepped toward Paris but turned profile, grabbing the swing's chains. She sat down on the leather seat and backed it up until she was positioned to push off. She smiled at him weakly. It was a request. Paris thought she was requesting his love, but not the risk of losing it. I know other stuff about Einstein, too, she said.
Tell me. Paris passed through both the park and the memory. He walked toward the duplex in the autumn chill through the north side neighborhoods of the aspiring working class and the liberal professionals. The houses weren't grand, but they were beloved. Matted raked leaves sat like black puddles on the dark lawns. These leaves were the last round, the round that might not make it into the dumpsters and compost piles, but would sit quiet under the snow until raked up in the spring with ice still clinging to their soggy brownness. The grass beneath would rise greener than the rest. He walked the blocks, allowing himself the hope that Tatum would be sitting on the front stoop of the duplex. He pretended that she had called him at work from home, choosing to ease back into his company, first just a voice, materializing slowly. But the stoop was empty. Love is a demotion. The lover ranks lower than the friend. This is how Paris remembered what Tatum had told him that night in the park. He had decided that for Tatum, such rankings must have to do with permanence, those we can keep as opposed to those we can't. Lovers were, undeniably, more slippery, more likely to come and go than were friends. Paris tried to understand her thinking rather than argue against it. He didn't want to frame an argument on love's behalf and risk it being a compelling one that wins her over but, in the end, isn't true. She could be right. He might not hold up under love's mighty scrutiny. When the hope for love outshines its reality, the beloved becomes a disappointment. And a person can't measure up to an idea, Paris knew. It was apples and oranges.
You've been listening to Kate Holava read from her novel, Shaking Out the Dead. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. If you'd like to hear this program again or subscribe to The Right Question podcast, go to mtpr.org/twq. You can also find links to audio on our Facebook page. We'll be right back to continue our conversation. Don't go away.
Kind of funny, this passage, when I read it, you know, I haven't actually read that particular one in a long time, and it reflects so much back on what we were just saying about Geneva and how love for her is so much in the head and so much about an idea of love. And here in this passage, you have Paris making the exact point that when love is an idea, then real love can't measure up to it or the lover.
I noticed that that came out in several of the characters in several of the scenes, this grappling with what love is.
Absolutely. And I also, obviously, you know, while I was writing it, was probably grappling with that as well. But in writing it, it was in the back of my head. It wasn't something I tried to craft into the book or anything, but I did feel like I was looking at love and how people approach it and how they try to understand it, you know, as they deal with their relationships and with their own hearts. And I felt in doing that, you know, almost that I was creating something that, in, like I say, in my mind was almost like a Rorschach test, that when you looked at it, what you thought of these characters and how they love or what they think of love or what makes one to be loving well is not, I think, undebatable.
And I just know from people who have read my book, and I've now sat with two different book groups, that it's interesting to me, and it's what I wanted in a way. You know, there are those who judge the characters differently in terms of their capacity to love, and did they love well, and did they love rightly. And that pleases me very much, you know, as the writer of the book, that that is something people talk about. And it makes me think that there is maybe a little bit of that Rorschach test, you know, quality about it. I had a dear friend, a man who was in his, I guess he's in his 50s, and he read it years ago. And his opinion about the relationship between Paris and Tatum, I thought was so interesting. And it made me think, boy, I bet your relationships just have a quality of the tragic about them, and learned later that they did. But I do think that's true, that for some people there is an element of tragedy necessary for them to feel that the experience of love itself is love. And there's others for whom having that element of tragedy is what marks it as not love. So I think that that's one of the dynamics, at least with one relationship in the book.
Right. And relating back to the rules that you learned in your family of origin, like somebody special because they have the name Rachel.
Right.
But there were many places in the story where people were struggling with rules, such as Geneva. She promised things in her wedding vows that were giving her trouble now in her early 60s.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was something else about Geneva that I liked very much, and I think is also open to debate as to whether it's wisdom or folly. She was committed to her commitments. So there's being committed to another human being, her husband. But for her to stay there and to love him and to be committed to him, it was so she knew she could trust herself, that when she committed to something, it meant something. Which is different than what we often think of as commitment, as you're committing to another person. And for her, it was more about living up to her own, to know that she is the person she thinks she is, and that when she makes a commitment, that commitment is real. So being loyal to her own word as much as being committed out of love to a partner or spouse.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to give listeners the idea that this book is all about these people thinking about love.
No.
There's a lot that happens.
Yeah. At Amazon, one of the comments of a reviewer that I really liked, you know, said that this book is about love, but this is not a romance, and it is not about romanticness. And I thought, yeah, that's true. It's the way that it is about love is much more grit than romance, I would say.
Yes. As I said, there's a lot to think about, and here's a passage I'd like you to comment on. Quote, "Facts are products of evidence, and evidence exists only in the past. So facts are products of the past. Making decisions based on them and using them to predict the future is to look into an old news crystal ball."
Well, like you said, there's a lot of little sub-themes that run through this book. And just like the Book of Rachel's is a product of the past. And so that whole dynamic within the book is just another example of that, as well as the cause and effect thing we talked about earlier. And I think this book has some concern with what kind of weight do we give the past? And does the past deserve any weight at all? And with that passage, I think it's another place in the book where that's popping up. I know later in the book too, there's something about Tatum, you know, feeling like she was stuck when in fact she was moving forward. You know, this was, you know, the narrator's voice comes in, but she was walking forward, but she was facing backward. You know, so she was, you know, judging where she was stepping based on what she was seeing, which was in fact, you know, the opposite direction of that she was walking in. So, and when I was writing this book, I have to say that was another idea that was playing in my own mind and in my own life is the weight of the past. And does it deserve any? And as you know, that's then a question for Geneva in the book as well. Is it important then for the child character in the book, Rachel, to have evidence of her past? Or does that then just serve as a weight to be carried, where if you don't know about the past, then is the weight not there? you know, or is it carried in some other way?
It was really something to think about, trying to make decisions without having facts and without depending on the past. I sat there and tried to do it. And I thought of all the people who say, you have a decision to make, you weigh the pros and you weigh the cons, and they're all based on facts. And so it was really mind-bending to try to make a decision with none of that. You would only rely on what? Your feelings.
You know, this could, you know, go into a whole philosophical, you know, sidetrack, but there's another way of thinking even about that out there called structural thinking, structural tension, where how to get where you're going is you look at where you want to go and you look at where you're standing, and because that's the track that you have to walk. You have to walk the track from where you are to where you're going, and the track of where you've been, if that's the ground under your feet, you're walking in the wrong direction.
So I see. Yes.
And again, and also I'm not trying to even say this is what I think is in this book. It's more of taking all that and thinking about it. And like I was saying, I think a reader can weigh in thinking that's ridiculous. Of course you need to have the past to rely upon. And as a writer, I would say it's more of me asking those questions than it is me saying, folks, I think this is the way it ought to be done.
Yeah, and it didn't come across like that in the book. It came across as something to think about, which I like in a book. Anything else you want to say about the characters or the plot or why you wrote the book?
You know, the book definitely pulled itself along, I would say. It's not that I'm not one of those people who had my outline that I sat down with and knew the book that I was going to write. In fact, I would say I absolutely did not know the book that I was going to write, right down to the character who I thought had the most wisdom at the beginning of writing this book was the character I decided did not have terribly much wisdom. So the characters pulled me along, the story unfolded to me, and you know, there were days where I would, you know, go to the computer and think, I wonder what's going to happen now.
You weren't relying on facts from the past.
I don't know. Life is so rich, you know, so there's always so much to pull in, you know. So I think that not having an outline wasn't a difficult thing. Who knows? Maybe the book would have been written faster if I had. But I like that every day, you know, there's a way the weather's behaving. You know, there's the thing you hear on the street. There's the thought that goes through your mind. But then all that becoming the mulch and the material of moving this story forward was, you know, was the adventure.
Kate Holova lives in southwest Montana. Look for more information about her and her book at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq or on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Sheree Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Sheree Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.